You're listening to Intellectual Erection,
a place where we talk about the naughty.
To stimulate your thinking.
You're listening
to
Intellectual Erection.
Intellectual Erection.
Передачу, где мы говорим о диспуте, там субъекты секса.
Hablamos de los sexos.
В компаниях, но мы говорим о
информации.
To stimulate your thinking. Welcome back to Intellectual Erection. I'm your host, Patrick, and we're not well into season two. We're just starting. This is the second episode. I hope you listened to the first one with Pastel Supernova. And now, this is Alicia Fisher.
First kiss, the oral sex, first penetration, various positions, position 1, 2, 3, 4, and then with 78% of the time, men reaching orgasm, and only 18.3% of the time, a female reaching orgasm, and then bada boom.
Specific numbers.
Yeah, research, right?
That's right. We got a spunky monkey here to talk to you about all sorts of sex positivity. She knows her shit, and you're going to hear it in this episode. I'm not going to take too much of your time, but I do want to say, if you want to support this podcast, and please do, go to patreon.com/intellectualerection, and you can become a patron, and there will soon be extra content on there, perhaps an ASMR episode where you get to hear all sorts of nasty little noises that we recorded, who knows? Shh, go and support. And if you can't financially, write a review, I've been asking, so, what are you doing with your day? I don't know, writing a review for Intellectual Erection. That sounds amazing. What a fun way to support a podcast without actually diving into your pocket. So, if you could do that, that would be greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening. 15,000 and plus listens over the last year. This is fantastic. Keep going. As always, listen, like, review, and most of all, enjoy. I'm sitting here today with
Alicia Fisher.
What does Alicia Fisher do for the audience, please?
So I am an international relationship, intimacy, and flirtation coach. And then in my other life, I work at the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center. I am the community engagement facilitator, young men leading change program coordinator, and mending program coordinator. So I think it's really important to include men in these conversations about ending sexual violence. And we know that not all men perpetrate violence, but all men, I'm going to say all men, are wanting to do something about it. So I coordinate these programs, and then I bring male-identified facilitators into the space to have these really tough conversations. Mm. That's a very brief overview.
That is very important, especially since so many women that I've met mm-hmm. have had some kind of story of breaching consent mm-hmm. or worse.
Yeah.
So a lot of the behaviors around sex and aggression and the social constructs that go with it, the chaser and the withholder sort of positions.
Yeah.
All this stuff needs to be kind of reassessed.
Yeah, and it's been amazing. I just started there in October, and the amount of people reaching out to us, there was actually just a news story that was out in right at the beginning of August about all the donations that we have coming in. And we're getting donations from elementary schools, concerts. There's like concert, what was it? I forget. It was at the Red Dog in Peterborough. And it was like a thrash metal concert. And they raised over $800 for us.
Wow.
Weddings are doing donations for us as well. And so we're doing talks. Like, I do community engagement. So I go around and talk to the community. And we're talking from people all the way from grade one through elementary school, high school, college, university, doctors, various athletic teams, Scouts Canada. So it's been a whole plethora of people just wanting more information about consent, healthy relationships, boundaries, and ultimately bystander intervention. So how do we get involved when we see something happening? And it can be really overwhelming to do the direct approach, which is where you are directly going into a situation and doing something. There's a lot of barriers to getting involved when we see something, whether it's seeing our friends or it being our friends and not wanting to upset the dynamic, or just our overall safety. We have a whole list of reasons why we don't get involved. And so those workshops, they're one of like the number one workshop people reach out to us for, just wanting information about how to get involved. So we talk about different techniques and then tools for getting involved. So
yeah, I think that's very important, because I've seen a lot of situations in which a bystander, could have been me, for example, mm-hmm. is watching a scene go down between two people, and I feel like intervening, but I don't know if it's my place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if my criticism is going to be welcome. I don't know if I read the situation right, and I'm also scared of the consequences, and I don't want to put myself at risk. But through having seen other people do it and having practiced it myself, I became more comfortable. And mm-hmm. now if I do see something go down, I have an approach that is non-threatening to mm-hmm. the parties involved, that just kind of acknowledges that the situation is happening, and I can talk about myself and say, you know, I witnessed this situation, it's making me uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Are you too okay? Does anybody need any help or anything like that?
Mm-hmm.
And then people can reply, and I'm not directly accusing them. I'm mm-hmm. just asking them a question. I'm saying, you know, this is making me uncomfortable. Is everything okay? Because if I'm uncomfortable, then maybe you are as well.
Exactly. So that would be some of the techniques mm-hmm. We talk about. So utilizing a calm, curious, and supportive approach. So if you're going into any situation and you're like, hey, I don't like what you're doing and you're going to stop right now, that's pretty accusatory. And the response you're going to get is, well, F you, bud. Like, yeah. you know, yeah. it's going to be pretty defensive. But if you go in and say exactly what you said, like, hey, is everyone okay here? It's being calm, curious, but you're also offering support. Like, is there anything that you need? And you're giving the choice back to someone who's potentially having their power and control taken away from them. And there's some situations where you don't know who the perpetrator is and who the victim is. So when you go in very calm and curious, just like you do, it's incredibly empowering for all parties really involved to be able to, as a perpetrator, step back and go, whoa, what am I doing? And for the victim to step up and be like, oh yeah, I'm actually just really thirsty right now, and it gives them a way out. So, yeah.
Sounds like sounds like good techniques to learn. And
yeah.
it's also put me, learning some of this stuff has put me into a more confident headspace to be able to engage with people,
mm-hmm.
even about things that are unrelated. If there's no direct victim in the scenario,
mm-hmm.
for example, I was in a bathroom taking a piss one time in a bar. Some guy comes in. He's a little bit drunk. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, man, oh, any bitches here tonight? And I just looked at him and I smiled and I said, do you mean women? And then he's
I
like,
I remember you talking about this at some point.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, yeah, man, yeah, oh, whatever. I'm like, yeah, you know, it's 2019. I'm like, it's, you know, mm-hmm. it's about respect.
Yeah.
And then there was another man there, and he looks back and he's like, yeah, he's nodding his head. He's like, yeah, man, show some respect.
Yeah.
So it got somebody else interested in like supporting my position, and the guy relented and he apologized, and then
yeah,
and it was okay.
And you're lucky, because especially if you're in a washroom mm-hmm. and you've consumed some sort of substance or beverage, what have you, you know, for them to be like, oh yeah, I see what you're saying, like, pretty lucky, because sometimes it's a
aggressive.
We go fuck bitches. And
but like, I said it with a smile. I said it almost like, yeah, I'm like, do you mean women? Kind of like that, you know, and with a kind of upward influx, just get like a pleasant sort of like nudge, like, hey, come on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, you know, it's 2019. I did the whole like Trudeau nudge, like, hey, it's 2019.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. So
did you have the wig on too?
I did
match
not
it?
Have the wig on. No.
Okay.
I'll do that next time.
Okay.
I'll get a little cutout and put my Trudeau face on.
Yeah.
Wow. So you are a busy human.
Yeah.
You just came back from a conference in Italy.
Yeah, that was in mid-July. So it was the Storytelling in the Body conference. Now, normally I wouldn't apply to a conference like that, because originally it was love and eroticness. Mm. So I applied to that, talking about navigating porn consumption and intimate relationships. And the people at the Storytelling in the Body conference, I guess, weren't really ready for me. And I talked after lunch. And apparently in Italy, there's wine for lunch that is just sitting at the hotel room that you can just drink.
Yep.
So, you know, I walk in there with my glass of wine after lunch, ready to talk about porn. And the organizers, they didn't have a quiet space for reflection, because porn can be an extremely triggering topic. So I pretty much demanded to the organizers that there needs to be a separate room. If people need to debrief, if people just need a quiet space to just be with themselves, there needs to be that space, especially with my kind of topic. Now, mind you, the amputation topic didn't get as much of a response, but I loved it. It was such a great
amputation.
Yeah, amputation and talking. There's this woman, she's from the States, and was talking about, it was like, she just, oh, it was so incredible. Just talking about people amputating parts of their body and like the eroticism
connect. Intentionally.
Yeah.
What kind of parts of their body?
Are those legs or arms?
Completely off.
They just didn't, she was talking about these individuals just not feeling connected to those parts of the body, and to get rid of it, it was just part of life for them.
Who sanctions these things? Do they just do it at home?
I don't know what they do in the States.
Right. But, so, yeah. I mean, there was an episode of Nip Tuck exactly on this, is somebody wanted to amputate their legs because they felt this disconnect with them and they didn't want to have the legs. And it was a real moral question about one's freedom to put themselves in a position of disability. So it's an odd topic.
Yeah.
And obviously the first screening is, are they mentally healthy? You know, are they doing damage to their body willingly? Or what is this? Because mm-hmm. it's hard to understand why anybody would want to put themselves
exactly
at a, you know, mm-hmm. presumable disadvantage. Mm-hmm. Amputation.
It was such a cool topic. And then you have me coming in with porn after lunch.
Well.
So unfortunately, when I found out that I was gonna, that the love and erotic conference was gonna be kind of put together with the storytelling of the body conference, I went, hey, can I talk about bodies in porn instead? Because love and eroticism is more about like a connection and communication, whereas storytelling of the body is like talking about body representation. So can I do a presentation on body representation in porn? And they're like, no, we like your original topic. And I'm like, all right, sure. So I go there, and sure enough, everyone wants to talk about the morality of porn and the bodies in porn. Hmm. And I went, wow, interesting how that works. So,
right.
You know, my talk went really well for 20 minutes, fitting in the history of pornography, stats on pornography, anti-pornography movement, feminist porn, how to talk about porn and relationships in 20 minutes. I did a fantastic job, but unfortunately my outfit was too sexy for some people, and they thought that people were going to objectify me, and that, you know, as a woman I shouldn't wear a gorgeous orange trumpet neckline dress.
Right, because it's up to you how people objectify your body.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah. You should be the one, you should be wearing a burlap sack, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
It was, it was definitely an interesting comment that I received. And ultimately my response is, I can't control how other people think about me. When I'm here as a international relationship, intimacy and flirtation coach, like I have my image, I have my brand, and this is the brand that I'm bringing. She's like, do you always dress like that? And I'm like, well, typically I wear my high heels to bed. So yeah, totally. So it was super frustrating, especially to be talking about the feminist waves and how we're moving and always navigating about the different contexts in terms of feminism and what it entails. And then just to go back to literally second wave feminism and about what women should wear and shouldn't wear, it was really, really upsetting. And then the organizer, there was a different organizer that they brought in, and he was just really policing us on our phones and saying that we shouldn't be on our phones and shouldn't be doing this. And I'm like, you know what? Like, I've got thousands of people on my social media feeds that are wanting to see how this is going.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to stop that, then okay. So.
So some hiccups. Definitely.
Yeah,
some hiccups,
you know,
I had a
fantastic time in Italy. I was in Verona. We traveled around. I met up with a friend up there, and it was really great. And my talk went really well, and I looked amazing and sounded amazing, and I got out all the key points I wanted to. Promoted Scene Sinclair. I love her so much. And yeah, I'll just focus on the good.
All right. Well, there's so much stuff here that I want to talk about. I have a million questions. But first, as always, and a little deep into the interview, is the origin question. Yeah, you look at you. I love it.
I didn't study for this.
Did you not? Do you know the question?
Yes. How did I get involved with this field of sexuality, or where were my first influences? Is that
it? There's that, and there's the deeper kind of like weirdly Freudian question that I also include in part of this. You can choose to answer it or not, but I'm always interested in your first sexual awakening. And what I mean by that is the first time, it usually happens around like 6 or 7 or something, maybe a little later or younger, where you became exposed to something that was sexual. And usually it's on TV, books, this, that, whatever it was that piqued your curiosity into sex, and at a time where maybe you didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, experiencing sex and sexuality was all very much a third-person experience, which is kind of interesting. And almost both of these questions go together because I talk about this in my international talks about how I study pornography and how I came across it. And so it was my dad's satellite porn.
Yes.
And yeah, right? Yep. And so I would be watching it and there was this gorgeous bombshell blonde woman who had like these ginormous tits and her little nipples were just popping through and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I can't wait for puberty. This is what I'm gonna look like and sound like. And obviously, that was a big failure. So I became really interested in bodies.
I choked when you were talking about... Pardon me.
So I became really interested in bodies and the way they move and how we connect sexually. Why are we flirting this way? Boys and girls club dances was when the body really started to take over in terms of what sexiness was, what being turned on was, and grinding at the Boys and Girls Club dances and wearing the thongs and stuff like that.
Oh, were you wearing the thongs that were piping out of the jeans a little
bit? Oh, yeah. That's what all the girls were wearing.
McDonald's arches.
Yeah, I had to like borrow a thong from like a friend because like I don't wear thongs. And so anyway, we all had to wear thongs to the dance. So I really felt like a third person watching everything because I felt so intrigued. And it wasn't necessarily because I was turned on, but I was fascinated with how other people got turned on. Why is it that guys like to smell my underwear? Why is it that when we were grinding that certain positions felt better than others? How did we connect? How did we flirt? How did we know that some people were interested in other people? You know, why is it when I rub up against a guy with my ass, I feel this like really hard thing appearing? And so I felt like so fascinated by it all. And for the longest time, I thought I was going into kinesiology. Like that's what my path was. I was really athletic going through school. And then the day before university applications were due, I was like, U-turn, I'm going to do psychology. Mm-hmm. So second year psychology is when I came across social psychology and studying close relationships and just how we all connect. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And so I came across a TMZ article that was talking about the American Idol contestants staying in Playboy TV's swing house. Did you know about this?
No.
So this is years ago.
What?
Yeah. And so I was like, were they staying in the Playboy mansion or were they staying in the swing house? I'm like, what's swing? So I turn it on and there is Dr. Jessica O'Reilly and she's bringing in these normal vanilla couples that are interested in the swing life. And they would come to this swingers house where there was a bunch of swingers and they would get to experiment, see what the swing life is like. And so the way karma works out is Dr. Jessica O'Reilly was speaking at the Everything to Do with Sex show literally a month later. And I went, I need to meet this woman because what she's doing and what she's talking about is what I want to do. So I went to two of her talks and I was really intrigued as to how she balanced entertainment with science and those differences and like, how do you keep the audience intrigued with science, but then also bring in the entertainment value? So after her two talks, I walked up to her and said, hi, Dr. Jess, my name is Alicia and I want to do what you do when I grow up. How can I do that? And she's like, here's my personal email. Email me. Oh, so nice. Yeah. So then she brought me to Oasis for my first event with Dr. Jess ever. And it was an oral sex workshop. So my first time ever being at Oasis and it being an oral sex workshop with the Dr. Jess, I was like, holy moly. And I'm there in my dress acting professional and everyone there is like naked with towels on. And I'm like, oh my goodness, what's going on? And so it was an absolute blast. And that just kind of trajected me into my career.
Okay, two questions from that.
Okay, that's it?
Yeah.
Come on.
First question is, who are these guys in high school that were sniffing your panties? Like, I'm just wondering.
They were very interesting people.
Did guys sniff your panties in high school?
It was grade 7. Grade 7 is when okay. They were...
Just tell me. You got to tell me this story.
I don't know. That. Like, it just... In grade 7, I don't know how these conversations even start, but it was just someone was just very intrigued by sniffing my panties, and I started to do some research about pheromones.
Wait,
while
you were wearing them, or did they come to your house and see your panties?
No, so I took a washroom break, and I'd put them in my backpack. And then, you know, a couple minutes later, he would take a washroom break, and then he'd go through my bag and
sniff your panties.
Sniff.
That's really hot.
I guess so. Yeah. So that's.
He brought this up. He's like, I'd like to sniff your panties.
I think it was an ongoing conversation and flirtation at a very young age.
Grade 7.
So it was just always, grade 7. And so it was, I wasn't necessarily engaged in a lot of intimate connections with other people, but I was very open about talking about it. And so, of course, I was slut shamed all throughout late elementary school, high school, naturally. But the thing
the
is,
best people are,
right?
Yeah.
And the thing that just always kept me going, because obviously, you know, mental health and depression and suicide all comes into it when you're getting bullied and numbers called at you in the hallway. But what always kept me going is that especially the guys in like the popular group would one of them would always like come up to me, like a whole bunch of them, but not all at once, but one of them would always come up to me with the most saddest questions about body image, about fitting in, and about loving themselves. And like my ability to just talk to them and just break down all these man box ideals about what it means to be a man and how to be cool, how to not be cool, like it just gave them space to be emotionally vulnerable. And so like they would never say anything when I walked by, but like, you know, they would kind of slowly start to be like, yeah, but did you guys watch the game last night, to kind of change the conversation.
Right.
So those were the little things in life that like always kept me going. And I'm like, this is what I got to do with my life. Like,
yeah,
this is
my, sounds like you already started early.
This is my calling. Yeah.
Okay. So the second question from that whole slew of things is, what made you interested in the sex aspect of psychology, entertainment, of all of it? Because you brought up the story going to see Dr. Jess, all this stuff. You had a trajectory in psychology, but it sounds like what you're saying is that there was this kind of thing inside that got awakened through seeing Dr. Jess, that all of a sudden you're like, wait, I want to do that. Why that? Why the sex?
I think because the sex is something that you don't talk about. You don't talk about the sex.
You don't talk about sex.
You don't talk. You don't ever talk about the sex. And
I
even
always talk about the sex.
I know you do, Mr. Intellectual Erection.
Wow.
But even in sex ed, you just never talked about the sex. And so I was like, why aren't we talking about the sex? And so this is where I took the time to educate myself, and people were just like fascinated talking to me, and just to see the relief and happiness that came through people talking to them about the sex. But it's not just the sex, like it's body image, it's masturbation, it's self-love, it's all these things, it's boundaries, it's, you know, everything, kink, identity, and just knowing that they have something within them, that it's okay to be horny, it's okay to not be horny, it's okay to be kinky, it's okay to not be kinky, it's okay to be, as a man, submissive when everyone's telling you to be dominant. And so it was always just seeing that ignition of passion in people's eyes when I talk to them. That's just what made me really want to get involved and do this. And so I've always taken a really interdisciplinary approach to my work. So not only do I have the academic and scientific side of me, I had the professional side of me, the clinician side of me, and then the also lived experiences where I'm talking to other people and bringing in those experiences, because science isn't always the direct depiction of reality. It's just the answer of that sample, if you will. You know, you can't be like, science says this, therefore it's applicable to the entire world and that's how it is.
Right.
In some circumstances, yes. In some circumstances, no. And so you can't just rely on science. In terms of the clinician world, there's so much more than just therapeutic frameworks that's gonna make people feel better. Sometimes it's actually going out and doing things. And in the clinician world, that's not something that's really accepted with them. They don't really want to tell people like, hey, let's go to the sex club and I'll show you around. And, you know, especially in just like everyday terms of clinician
maintain
therapy.
Maintain professional distance.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's one of the big reasons why I left the more therapeutic world. I have a lot of training in family therapy frameworks, intensive sex therapy training, and it just turned me off of it so much, because there were people there who had been involved working as a, not necessarily a licensed sex therapist, but just as a therapist for 35 years and couldn't become accredited because they didn't have one 5-day course. And that infuriated me. And the organizer of this intensive sex therapy was just like, yeah, if there's coaches out there, they're not real intellectual people. Like, they don't really know how to do things, except we've got Carlisle coming in, owner, good for her. Like, she's different. Like, she's doing something different. So, like, you know, she's really, really smart. But, like, if you're a coach, like, you're not, it's a different type of knowledge and it's not real clinician work. And So that really pissed me off, to be honest. I was quite perturbed to hear that I was educating the real clinicians at my table about sexuality, sexual orientation, intimate connections. But I was at a sex therapy training program, but yet I was the one educating people in terms of intimacy. So I get it. It's a little bit different when you come from social work and then you're incorporating sex when it's like social work, sex, bad, don't talk about it, it's not good. You know, sex is bad. Sex is what harms people. And it's like, well, sex can also be something that liberates people. And I think if we have like a one-way view of it, it really limits our understanding of how it can't be beneficial, but also how it can harm.
Right. Okay. There's a lot in that to dig through, but Essentially I think the people who are accredited or have the academic background will often have a weariness to people that call themselves life coaches or anything that doesn't have accreditation, because there's no standardized measure to look at this person and judge whether or not they're bullshit artists mm-hmm. or if they're genuine, the real thing. So I think that's where their skepticism comes from. Mm-hmm. Because with my training as well, we have this kind of similar mentality. But you've got your academic training, you have mm-hmm. your real life training, you've got courses and courses. It sounds like you've been through a lot of things, a lot of accreditations, a lot of conferences, which brings me to what I want to talk about right now.
Okay.
Your porn work.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah. I want to know in a big nutshell. Like, think of a coconut.
Mm, okay.
It's not a real nut, but it doesn't matter. Just break down for me what it is that you talked about in Poland and in Italy. What it is that you talk about in porn when you're talking about numbers and statistics and all this kind of stuff, plus feminist porn, non-feminist porn, the shift to more feminist porn. You know what to talk about. I don't need to prompt too much.
No, it's all good. So I did my master's in cultural analysis and social theory. So totally random, but what I really wanted to do was a cultural analysis of porn consumption, especially online porn consumption. That's what I really look at and study. So what I wanted to do is look at the trends. Where are the trends heading? What are people looking for? What are people wanting? And then what I ended up finding is equating that to more feminist, ethically produced pornography. They're two different things, but they are somewhat aligned. So I'll get to that in a bit. But what I do, I look at a lot of Pornhub. So I know people roll their eyes at Pornhub and go like, oh gosh, you're looking at the devil. Like, the Pornhub's terrible. And
take 1 second, grab the shirt right behind you.
I know. Yes, I saw it when I came in.
And the panties.
Yeah, Pornhub's terrible. So, oh God,
you love it. It's okay. You just tossed a pair of Pornhub panties over into the distance.
Sorry. Oh, it's okay. Collect you later. You can take a nap. So, Pornhub sucks. It's terrible. It's all stolen. It's taking away people's genuine art. And it's like, yes, I get it. But the current stats are that 100 million people per day are going on this website. MindGeek, who owns Pornhub, Reality Kings, YouPorn, and Brazzers, are part of the top three bandwidth consuming companies worldwide. The other two being Netflix and Google.
Wow.
So they are sending out a lot of erotic imagery. And so, yeah, like, it kind of sucks having to go by that, but that's what so many people are going to, 100 million people per day. So what I found is that in 2017, words like female-friendly porn, and then going into 2018 with trans, romance, are all of a sudden starting to really show themselves in terms of what people are wanting to see in terms of intimate connections playing out online. And so I was really excited by trans because I'm like, cool, like, people are looking up trans. Like, oh yeah, it's probably all like the 18 to 35 age group wanting to learn more about trans identities. But that's actually not true. So it's the 31 to 44 and then the 64 age plus age groups are the ones that are looking for trans porn the most.
Wow.
And so I think I heard you talk about this in an earlier podcast where the identified categorical representation of trans is now gone from shemale and tranny to trans female to male and trans male to female, which is like amazing. And so like it's kind of that balance of, are they looking at it for a fetishization or are they looking at it to educate themselves? And I think it's both. I think there's a mixture. I think people are wanting to learn more about trans bodies, wanting to learn more about, are they real people? And for people who are listening on the podcast, I just did some really great air quotes for that. Sometimes I gotta, you know, make it clear what I'm saying.
But, the air quotes.
Yeah. And so I think it's a mixture, and I think that people are wanting to look at more real bodies experiencing pleasure. We are sick of that regimented story of the first kiss, the oral sex, first penetration, various positions, position 1, 2, 3, 4, and then with 78% of the time men reaching orgasm, and only 18.3% of the time a female reaching orgasm, and then bada boom.
Specific numbers.
Yeah, research, right? And then that's it. But we know that it's not like that. And then sometimes within the first 5 seconds, someone's reaching orgasm, and you know, I've seen it before. And so it's we know that sex and intimate connections are not that regimented penile vaginal intercourse state. Like, there's so much more to it. There's so many different types of connections. And when I was talking to Jordy, who's been part of your podcast before, like looking up BDSM and fetish and kink, like, you can't really see that in terms of Pornhub. And what's really fascinating on Pornhub is that there's no categorical representation of BDSM. It's actually filtered under hardcore, rough sex, and fetish. So the types of BDSM that you're receiving are kind of like the 50 shades of gray bullshit.
Right.
And so people are wanting to learn more about BDSM and kink, and so you go to Pornhub to learn about it, because that's where it's going to show up. And then it's this hair pulling and people gagging and vomiting and, you know, whips and chains and, you know, stuff everywhere. And sometimes, yes, BDSM can be that, but it's not all of that. And that's what you really start to see. And so I think that's incredibly dangerous, because MindGeek is part of the software company that was involved in banning online access to porn in Britain. So if the representations of people are white, able-bodied, cisgender, heterosexual, like fit kind of bodies being represented, which is what happens when you go through the categories on Pornhub, with the exception of, you know, non-cisgender categories, racialized categories, safe for work, big dick and orgy categories, all the rest are all represented by white people.
Yeah.
So what people are seeing is not the depiction of reality, and I think that's incredibly harmful. And this is where the conversation kind of turns to porn literacy. And there's some research that came out in 2019 about the importance of porn literacy and how we need to start talking about it, because then that mitigates the fetishization of it, right? When you're told not to do something, don't look up porn, don't have sex, what are you going to do? Well, we all know how great abstinence education is working. We know how great prohibition came out. So by pushing things to the shadows and hiding things away, you're not going to get the right information. And that's what's kind of happening. Yeah.
Wow. So, okay. Yeah. I mean, boy, there's a lot in there. No.
I didn't even get to like the feminist porn and ethically produced porn stuff. Yeah.
I think we talked about that on the podcast before in other contexts where, you know, the two feminist movements came out of porn consumption, or the idea of porn consumptions and the critiques from feminists.
So it wasn't necessarily porn consumption. It was actually the misogynistic imagery connected to media. Mm-hmm. And so what was profitable at the time for feminists to do is connect with the church groups, connect with government organizations and say, yes, we need to ban porn. It's really, really bad.
Yeah. So that's the sex negative feminist movement. And then the sex positive feminist movement was reclaiming pornography and those sorts of images and trying to find ways to empower multiple, various, diverse kinds of bodies while also maintaining healthy things like pleasure, right? Nudity, eroticism, all of it. So yeah, I think that's been covered a little bit in some of the other podcasts I've talked to people about, but I'm sure we can also dedicate an entire episode to that at some point.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to know about the numbers in the porn industry, and that it's not just Pornhub. It's a monolith behind Pornhub, owning several companies. Mm-hmm. And the progress within porn is incremental.
Mm-hmm.
Right, some categories have changed. Yes, shemale is no longer shemale or tranny. Now it's transgender. Mm-hmm. But you click on it and all the titles are still, mm-hmm. yeah, all the hashtags are still the old derogatory terms. And the representation in porn is slowly also and incrementally getting there. You're getting a little bit more diversity.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still things, issues of body images, and mm-hmm. there are also things that are not being depicted really well in porn, or they're very difficult to find.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking for specific kinds of role play, mm-hmm. it's so hard to find with the filters that exist, you know?
And even people with disabilities, it yields less than 200 results. So there's that too.
Yeah, so I guess it's like a supply demand sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people think are turning to webcamming now.
Yeah.
They'll go to a webcam, and if they find a couple or an individual that they like, they might tip them so that that person can perform the specific thing that they're interested in, provided that you know, that mm-hmm. performer is willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another booming sort of market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, virtual reality is huge. Mm. Technosexuality is what I like to call it. So it's technosexuality. Yeah, I heard about it at the Playground Conference back in 2015, I believe it was. Not the last one, the one before it. So yeah, and I think that the whole technology side of the porn industry is exploding at an exponential rate. We've got the baby boomers that are still horny and want to fuck, and unfortunately STI rates are exploding among them, and they are still horny. They want to connect, and you know, they're needing some apparatuses, some support to help with that. So mm-hmm. anyway, yeah.
So there's a lot of things in the works right now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of exciting stuff. So aside from your porn,
mm-hmm.
okay, some of the other stuff that you do. I mean, you have a radio show
yeah.
that you do where you talk about relationship stuff, sex, intimacy, all of it. But you have the three primary categories that you describe, which is research, I believe.
Yeah, academic, scientific stuff,
mm-hmm.
Professional work, clinician work, and then the lived experience.
Ooh, we'll mm-hmm. get the lived experience last. No, we won't. Shaking your head. Okay, fine. Fine. But we talked about some of the academic stuff,
mm-hmm.
and you go to conferences, you talk about porn, and you talk about certain things, but you also said you're an intimacy,
mm-hmm.
relationship, and flirtation coach. I'm so interested in the flirtation coach stuff. So I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about it, and maybe we can do a little bit of the workshop stuff that you engage in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what's exciting, my radio show, we're starting season two, so up and running in September right now, which is great. Can maybe collaborate timing and it can all work out. But yeah, on my radio show, there's a whole plethora of different kinds of people that their lives intersect with sexuality. So I had a spiritual coach on there in season one. I had one of the top beatboxers in Canada that was in there talking about oral pleasures and beatboxing.
Ooh.
You know, yeah. So he was a little reluctant. I had to pull back some layers to get him to open up when he was ready. We had Jordy on there talk about BDSM. And yeah, so a whole variety of different ways. Social anxiety, which was one of like the most sought after like radio interviews I did, because like so many people experience that in a variety of ways. So to go into kind of what I do, so in terms of flirtation coaching, I was actually on a TV show, which it's going to be airing in its next season, but I was just teaching people how to flirt, how to connect, what are some of the different social psychological components that come into how we connect with other individuals. And so I talked about it more so from like a behavioral way, so like how our bodies are, where we're looking, what we're talking about, how we're touching people. So touching is one of the bombs. It's either going to go really, really well, or it's going to like absolutely hit the fan. So it was really fun because on the TV show I was on, it was a lesbian. And so touching the face is like the number one. It's you're going to go really good, really, really well, or it's just going to not go good at all. And so it's so easy to touch a man's face because typically they have some sort of facial hair. And so I kind of had to like reword that conversation to be like, oh yeah, like the earrings or like the jawline or something like that, or like to like fix the hair or something. Mm-hmm. So and then we did like a little role play as to like how to like initiate a conversation. We brought my friend Lilith. She is my vulva puppet. So they were talking about their vulva puppet friend, and these lesbians had no idea what to say. They were like, what is, oh my god, oh my, is this what I think it is? So nice. We had a lot of, the producer's like, this is gonna get cut, but this is hilarious, keep going. Like, it was so funny. But yeah, so like I teach people like how to talk to people, and that can be really overwhelming, but it can be really rewarding too. And even just to like connect with people in a variety of different contexts, like whether you're in the middle of a mosh pit at a concert or if you're at like a coffee shop, there's different ways that we can approach people and talk to people and connect with people.
All right, well, let's try some of it.
Oh,
I'm curious. Okay. You're gonna teach me how to flirt?
Yeah.
Can we do that?
Okay.
All right.
For sure. Yeah. So, you know, we had a really great like connection. We walked in the door, like, you know, did the whole hug thing. Yeah, like physical touch can be really, really great. Obviously, physical touch is not some people's love language, right? And I think we already have like an ongoing relationship, so we kind of know how things right. are. But to start with body language, so the feet are actually one of the most like number one most telling ways about what people are thinking. So if both of my feet are pointed in like an opposite direction, my attention is going to be focused like on your painting as opposed to being focused with you. I've turned it purposefully, by the way, purposefully. Okay. But if my feet are turned to you, my hips are turned towards you, my shoulders are towards you, it shows that I'm engaged with the conversation and that like I'm right here with you or with the webcam, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Something's it's blocking something, so who knows what's going on behind the webcam.
I'll keep my secrets.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, body language is really, really important, and it's really telling too. Like if I am like, you know, my hips and everything are pointed at you, but my shoulders pointed toward my drink, and maybe I'm looking at my food. Like, it's kind of a good indicator of like, hey, do you need another drink? Right? So it's like paying attention to people's body language. Eye contact is also like a really great one, but you don't want to be staring like too intently, because then that gets like really, your whole facial expression just changed with that. So it's like, you know, you want to like blink while you're looking at someone. I know it's really awkward talking about eye contact when you're like actually doing it. But we talked about eye contact at the workshop with Jordy and the love languages, and how if you stare at someone for 2 to 3 minutes, you can fall in love. But to incorporate kink into it, if you like one person stands up while the other person's kneeling, it's a totally different dynamic. Anyway,
that was so hot.
Yeah. What? Like just the littlest thing.
Yeah.
We tend to think with BDSM that in kink and fetish play that it's just like some grandiose, like big actions, but just standing up and kneeling down.
Yeah.
And while looking at each other.
So a little bit of context for this. I was at your workshop with Jordy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a moment where we're talking about love languages. We're talking about just looking in your partner's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was with a relatively new human with me that day. who I just...
New to Canada.
And new to Canada as well. I was showing them around. That day I just met them. And they asked to be shown around, so I brought them to Oasis because that's the type of person that I am. So we did this exercise together, and we're just looking at each other into each other's eyes and trying to kind of calm all those nerves and all the processing and the thoughts, and that it's okay to look at each other because we're being asked to. But then there was the moment where one of us is meant to kneel down, mm-hmm. and then just keep eye contact. So she's kneeling in front of me and just looking up at me,
mm-hmm.
and that was so hot, just mm-hmm. that look from that angle, because it suggests so much, mm-hmm. yet nothing is happening, mm-hmm. and knowing that both those things exist simultaneously, the possibility but the negation of the possibility also because of where we are and what we're doing, was just really, really intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a really, really fun workshop. We're talking about the 5 love languages, a physical touch, quality time was that love language, words of affirmation, gift giving, and acts of service, which I guess that could be, that's not really an act of service, but yeah. And it was so hot, and the physical touch, we purposefully left that one to the end too, because like what Jordy did, he slapped someone across the face and walked away, and it was like, okay, you know, whatever. And then he slapped that same partner across the face and just held the face and just stared at the face. So it was like that physical touch, but you could just like feel that energy. I don't know, I felt it somewhere, but I felt it.
That's the connection. Yeah,
yeah, somewhere. Exactly. So yeah, ton of fun. So back to flirtation, I also incorporated like how to talk to someone and how to start conversations. And what's really great, what I've learned in my past, especially going to job interviews, if I'm the one talking too much and I come out of it being like, I talked a lot and it was really, really great, it means that the other person wasn't necessarily reciprocating. So if you're trying to get someone to like you, get them to talk. I know it's kind of a backwards way of thinking about it, because, you know, obviously you want to talk about yourself because you're the most number one interesting person in the world. But getting someone else to talk about their life, their interests, you learn so much about them. I don't know if you've ever had any experiences with getting people to just talk for an hour. I don't know if you know anything about that, but
nope.
No, yeah.
Just here. Nope.
Just not hanging either. Out. These microphones, I don't even know how they got here. Are they here the whole time?
Nope.
Have you been recording this?
I don't know. Oh, no. It might be.
Shh. Yeah. Keep going.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing that you mentioned first, which is the body language, is very important to me. It's actually the reason that I'm doing the podcast. So to put two and two together, I started this podcast because I was interested in nonverbal consent. And I wanted to interview people in the community and get them to theorize nonverbal consent, because I saw it happening a lot in the communities. And nobody's talking about it. Nobody's theorizing it. Yet it makes up a huge portion of the consent language that we use. And because we don't talk about it, it leaves it in a dangerous playground where people can willfully be ignorant and say, I didn't understand because you didn't say it. I'm like, but you are so good at reading body language and you know that. And if you're not, then that's something you can learn. But most of us are pretty good at reading body language. When you mentioned like the directional approach, right? Is my body angle towards you? It shows that I'm interested. Or at least, in the least, it shows that I'm not disinterested, right? And you know that at a bar. If you turn to somebody beside you and you start talking to them and they maintain their focus right at the bar, they don't turn their body to you, they don't look at you, but you keep going and you keep talking to them.
Yeah.
That's awkward. Stop. Right?
Yeah.
But if the person starts looking at you, smiles, turns their body to you, keeps their body, like keeps that kind of body language going with you, then you have reason to believe that they might be interested, or at least in that conversation.
Exactly.
So I think that the body language is hugely important for flirtation, arousal, all of it. And reading it, it's either you're going to be competent or not in it, but you can learn it. But ignoring it and then pretending like you don't know about it, I think that's filthy, and that needs, not in the good way either, and that needs to be addressed.
And the way we talk about consent and the questions that we always get are, what if this and what if that? What if we're in a long-term relationship? What if we've been drinking? What if we've been in a long-term relationship and we are both drinking? Is that non-consensual? So what we say is that if you're under the influence of any sort of substance or alcohol, then like those acts are non-consensual. Now, can you have consensual sex while you're under the influence? Yes, but it increases your risk of harm. So that's how we talk about it, is that yes, it can happen, but your ability or your risk of harming someone is dramatically increased. Same thing if you just met the person and, you know, you've been drinking, whatever. When you add on all these things, like, yeah, you could have a really great experience, but your risk of harm is dramatically increased.
Right. And there's so much. I mean, I just heard somebody that I know today tell me a story of how their ex-boyfriend was mad at them. They had an argument and they started playing, and this person's idea of kind of revenge in the moment through that anger was just going to going straight for anal without asking and just plunging in like that into that painful situation. I'm like, that is at least a breach of consent. At worst, it's rape, and you can be raped by your partner.
100%.
Yeah. So it's fucked up. So yeah, it doesn't matter on how well you know the person. It doesn't mean you can't be awful to them and harm them. So yeah, there's a lot to be learned in the, I think in the,
I forget what year it was, but it was up in, I swear it was like either the 60s, 70s, early 80s that you couldn't rape your wife. Like in Canada, there was no legal thing. So it's like, this is still a relatively new law, if you will. Like people were alive when you couldn't rape your wife. So I can see why this whole Me Too movement and these conversations around consent can be difficult. So for the Young Men Leading Change program, I do at the CORE, the Sexual Assault Center, that is for newcomer and racialized young men. And what I was told, I also ran a women's group, same thing, of newcomer international women. And they were like, in India, silence equals consent. Silence is yes. So you can see why these, it's very difficult to navigate that, especially being an international student when you're like, hey, well, like they didn't say anything. And like consent isn't something that's like on the Canadian customs test. Yeah. Like you're not learning about all the Canadian laws, especially in terms of consent. So you can see why these conversations get really, really tough. But I think what we need to do is just support our friends is what it all comes down to. And these could be our friends, our peers, coworkers, family members, etc. How we respond to a disclosure can totally change the trajectory of the rest of their life and how they are able to handle trauma, because if the number one person in their life doesn't believe them, then who will? So right. It could take a long time before you reach out to someone else to be like, hey, this happened. So saying things like, I'm really sorry that this happened, I believe you, what do you need right now, and I can connect you with supports are four incredibly powerful messages. And your job in that moment is not to be a judge. It's not to go, yeah, well, what were you wearing? Like, did you say no? Like, were you really, you know, that's not your job. Your job is just to support your friend and make sure that they feel comfortable and can do what they need to do to thrive and to move on in whatever capacity that they may see fit. It could be still be with the perpetrator and still love them, because we know in terms of our responses to trauma, freeze, flight, fight, and fawn is part of our traumatic response. And when we love the person who's harming us, it lessens our risk of harm. So that's a totally normal response in terms of survival mode. So yeah, part of the lessons I give in terms of,
wow,
yeah, it's powerful, right?
So freeze?
Freeze, flight, fight, and fawn.
Fawn.
Yeah. Hmm. Fawn. You love the person who's harming you, because that's the best way you can survive.
Right.
There's so many articles that are coming out about how difficult it is to get out of relationships. We know in Canada, these are Canadian statistics, every 2.5 days, a woman is dying of femicide at the hands of her intimate partner or past intimate partner. So these are statistics. And now the question always comes, well, what about men? Yeah, in the last 20 years, there's been 10 deaths. So there's your stats for men. It's always a question I get next, but so it's hard to leave. In Peterborough, we had a 70-year-old woman. She went, okay, I'm not happy in my relationship. Like, I'm going to be moving on. And so it was like maybe 5 months after her divorce, she was at a Home Hardware. Her ex-husband came up, shot her in the head with a gun. So like, that's why it's hard to leave. And that's why people just can't leave. We know that the housing crisis right now that's going on, you just can't leave and just walk into a new apartment and be like, okay, great, here we go. Yeah. Like, finances, if you have joint bank accounts, anyways, there's a whole vast amount of barriers that impact how we leave or don't leave relationships. And safety planning is always the number one thing to consider, which a lot of sexual assault centers will do for you for free.
Wow. Places that you work at.
Yeah,
this is part of your job. You have such a multifaceted approach to this. Like, I feel like we need several episodes just to get it out. I don't even know what things I'd like to tackle here. There's so much.
We talked about porn.
We talked about flirtation a little bit. I mean, there's still some things I'd like to ask about flirtation. Maybe the verbal aspects.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to get to a little bit of those before we move on?
Yeah, certainly. So like asking a lot of open-ended questions that aren't too direct. Like, are you a fan of Tom Brady when he threw that ball in game 5 against Philadelphia? And how...
Oh, I'm so sorry. I think my friend's calling me. Don't talk to me about sports.
Yeah, but you also don't want to be like too general, right? You don't want to be like, yeah, sports.
Do you like them?
Yeah. It's like, yeah. But, and, you know, taking things from your environment and talking about them too. Like, oh yeah, there's football on the TV. Do you watch any of that? It's like, oh yeah, you know, time to time. And like, oh yeah, when do you watch it? All of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, I watch it with my family when we're having dinner and doing, I don't know, family-like things. It's, oh, do you still live with your family? And, you know, you can roll from that. So it's really important to not only like verbalize questions, but then listen to them. So practicing like active listening skills. So we talk about it in terms, I hate going back to the sexual assault center, where like repeating what someone says, like we talk about that as an active listening skill, but that gets really annoying. Like,
well, I mean, I use paraphrasing. I prefer paraphrasing. So I'll listen to what you said and I'll say, I'll, you know, parrot it back to you in my own words.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that, you know, this and this and that.
Yeah.
And that makes you aware that I acknowledged and heard what you said and that I'm interested.
And you have to do it in a way, it's a hard line to kind of navigate, because you don't want to be like, oh, so I heard that you watch sports with your family. And it's like, well, that's what I just said. So, yeah, it's definitely difficult to kind of like navigate that whole...
The paraphrasing. It's important to do, I think, when there's like a message in somebody's story that you want to hear more about.
Yeah.
That's a good time to paraphrase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Or like, did you watch this? Oh, yeah, you watch football? Like, did you watch the Super Bowl? Oh, yeah, I watched it 3 years ago. Cool. What did you think about Lady Gaga's performance? Oh, I hate her. Oh, my gosh, me too. I didn't just legally change my name for her or anything. But, yeah, you know, you get to learn a lot about people through those kind of questions. So it's like kind of taking something general but not too general and kind of like harrowing in, right? And when you take like a general thing too, like that could be something of interest for you. But what you want to do is really unpack kind of like who this person is and try to get to know them.
Yeah. All right. Wonderful. So research, porn, flirtation, intimacy coach. Wow. What kind of advice do you give people that you talk to about intimacy?
Yeah, a lot of the questions that I tend to get from men are about masturbation frequency, and sometimes it's like genuine like curiosity, and sometimes it's like, is my dick too small? Like, here's a picture of it. And I'm like, oh my goodness, like
people do that to you.
So it's like you can feel the sincerity one aspect, but at the same time they're like, here's my picture, like what do you think about this picture, do you think it'd be good in this position, oh you go to Oasis, I saw you did a workshop, can we go together? And it's like, you know, the direction of the question, it's like, you know, underneath I can feel what you're kind of asking, but at the same time, like, so I kind of will rephrase. I was like, yeah, like I see you're really interested, yeah, Oasis is really great, here's some information about it, bye-bye. There you go. So, and then from women, because it tends to be more heterosexual relationships that reach out to me over social media, but I do support all different types of relationship structures, identities, sexual orientations, what have you. But when women reach out to me, it's more so about the lack of intimacy and connection, and they feel as if something is missing. I have one client who's reached out to me, and she just had a kid, and her partner isn't turned on by her anymore. So now she's like, can you tell him to get more turned on by me and to do this? And I'm like, well, your partner has to reach out to me if he wants to make a change. Like, you know, you can't change how someone's like turned on by you, but you can have like an ongoing conversation. I always say that, you know, a conversation with the entire relationship structure is the best conversations that can have or that can happen. Because, you know, she's saying he's not attracted to me and he's not having sex with me anymore. And he's going, oh, well, she's focusing on the kid too much, so I don't get me time. And they both point at each other, and the whole purpose of the conversation is deflected elsewhere. So, I always say it's really important for people to come together and to, like, have these ongoing conversations. Like, okay, you're saying you want the sex. You're saying your focus is elsewhere. So how do we change that focus into sex? Is kind of what I break down to. Some women reach out to me about their partner masturbating too much. And I'm like, okay, well, let's break down that question a little bit. Like, what is it are you upset with? Like, is the masturbation frequency impacting your day-to-day activities. Like, were you late for a family event because he had to masturbate and do whatever he was doing? Or is it that, you know, he's masturbating when you wish that the dick was on your face? So, right, it's kind of like unpacking those questions a little bit. And it kind of, a lot of these questions I'm getting, this is why I call myself an intimacy coach, is that it's not just the penetrative sex, it's the connection behind it. And also social media too. Like, we know social media hates sex educators and they hate sex workers and they hate anything to do with sex. So they try to block you and shadow ban you. So that's kind of part of the reason. Yeah. I've never experienced that before. So that's why I've kind of branded myself as intimacy, because intimacy is so much more. It's energy play. It is the penetrative sex. It's also oral and all different types of connections.
It sounds very aloof, floral, and not raunchy.
Yeah.
Well, but it can be.
Well, like, I try to focus my interactions on passion. So how do we cultivate passion? Therapeutic techniques tend to cultivate companionate love, whereas, like, well, you don't want to face fuck your companion. Right. So, and what I say is that when we get into those long-term relationships, we always hear, like, oh, I married my best friend. Like, they're my lifelong partner. Like, I really deeply care about them. Like, we have a really great connection. But I never hear them talk really dirty and treat them like the piece of meat that they treated their partner at the beginning of the relationship, right?
This is my cum slut.
Exactly. And as we learned in the words of affirmation at the Oasis event, like, that can be really empowering and can pump up the passion.
Yeah.
So, you know, I talk about passion. It's really great, but it kind of neurologically messes us up. We're kind of a little bit irrational. We got the testosterone, norepinephrine all pumping through us, and we just want the sex. Everything that our new partner does is like a little bit of anxiety provoking. It gets us like hot and bothered and excited. The way that they walk their dog is hot, and you just want to, you know, throw them down on the grass and do them doggy style as well. Like, you know, everything is really hot and sexy. And then after 6 to 8 months, it kind of gets a little bit like, okay, we're walking the dog again. Yep, here we go. So what I say is, like, walk the dog in the opposite direction. Little things that you can do to kind of be like, ooh, this is new. This is different.
Wow. So you deal with a lot of really interesting questions from a lot of people in a lot of different areas of your life. It is very robust.
I say I instead of the jack of all trades, master of none, I just say I jack off the trades and masturbate to the rest. So yeah,
you're gonna be quoted on that one.
Thank you.
I love it. Okay,
you're welcome.
So one thing
pay
I want to ask you before
I was like, pay me. No, I'm just kidding.
Pay you. Ooh, yes.
No. Money, you pay me in other ways. Thank you for the wine.
Money is a fetish, right?
I like the wine.
Okay,
which we're not drinking right now.
Roja.
This is just grape juice.
Grape juice. Yeah. No, we're drinking wine because we're fucking adults. Now, one thing I want to ask you before I let you go. I'm so overwhelmed by the amount of experience you have. I need to have you back on. So please say yes in the future. And we can be very specific about whatever topic.
Oh, you twisted my arm.
Yes.
Of course I'll come back.
Awesome.
And I'll actually come back this time in a time frame that's not 4 months away from when I said I was initially going to come on.
Yeah, yeah, that was some long edging. Now, what I want to ask is, before I pull you out of the hot seat, is if you have a favorite story. I want to hear a favorite story from work, from conferences, from questions that you've been asked. Is there anything like really kinky, wild, interesting, fun, dramatic, whatever it is, go for it.
So I don't have a favorite client, but my favorite client, he is a typical hockey player, goon, Canadian boy, hairy, tall, muscular. And back in the day, we had some connections in high school. And so it was like 5 years later, he reached out to me on Facebook. And he was like, Alicia, I don't know who to talk to about this, but like, you're the only person that I can talk to. You're the only one that, you know, won't judge me and stuff. And I'm like, wow, what a concept. Someone won't judge you for something that makes you happy. But anyway, he was like, you're the only one. And he's going on. Like, let's talk about edging. He was going on and on. Like, are you sure? Like, I just don't want to overwhelm you. Like, I'm really interested in this. And I'm like, hun, like, you can tell me anything, you big, hairy, hockey goon, beat the crap out of people kind of guy. And so he's like, well, Alicia, I really like being a sissy bitch. And I went, Ooh. Okay, that's great. Can you talk more about what that means to you? Because sissy and bitch can be two totally different things. So can you talk about what that experience means to you, how you like to experience this, what you like to do? Talk to me about it. And it's like the floodgates open after that point. So, you know, he's like, I like to be dominated by women. I like to wear women's clothes. Like, I'm not attracted to men, but like, I'll suck a dick if she tells me to. Like,
right.
I will
force bisexuality.
I will do anything to be a sissy bitch and to just bow down to the woman who's going to be in charge of me. And so what was really difficult for him is that he was in a relationship at that time and hadn't told his partner. And so we were strategizing as to how to bring it up in their relationship. And my favorite thing is always, oh, I saw on TV this. I was kind of laughing at it. What do you think about it? And like, that's always the best. Or like, oh, I heard Dick and Jane down the hallway was talking about this at, you know, wine and cheese night. I don't know. Yeah. And so what do you think about it? So anyway, he casually brought it up and his girlfriend at the time lost it, called him disgusting, who the F would do something like that. And so it's really difficult to navigate and to tell, like, not tell someone that, like, that relationship is not going to last. But, you know, kind of massage that out, like, okay, so, like, how did you feel in that? And just, you know, is this something that can be negotiated and, you know, in the most, like, lightest way possible, trying to, because I'm not here to tell people how to live their lives. I'm here for them to, you know, connect them with supports and guide them. And so that relationship unfortunately ended. And so he's been on his own little journey and it's been really great. He dressed up, he likes dressing up as a woman. So he actually went to a Blue Jays game dressed up as a woman. And he's like, Alicia, this was the most like liberating thing I'd ever done in my life. Like I was so turned on, but I was in my little cock cage and the key was thrown away. Oh, my little clitty. He always talks like that. And it's the cutest thing ever. And I know I say cute, but like that, like to me, just brings me so much genuine joy. So, you know, I don't have a favorite client, but he's definitely up there.
That is amazing. And it's really wonderful to hear a story of somebody kind of coming out of their shell like that, because that is a very, very difficult thing to do with masculinity being such as it is and machismo and all these things, to actually identify as a sissy and to want to come out and to explore those things. And most people don't even know what that means. I mean, I think I talked about it on one episode of the podcast, what sissification is. But if you're curious, do go to Pornhub, pump in a sissy hypno, and you'll see what you get. If you Google it, you're going to have a good time.
I'm excited.
Well, I mean, I can't describe everything about it. I think you did a pretty good job, but
it's different for every person.
It's like a forced feminization and being submissive in that capacity. And sometimes that does involve forced bisexuality. And that doesn't necessarily make the person interested in homosexuality. But being put in the position of being humiliated in that way is the erotic element for the individual involved. So, yeah, that's a wonderful story. And it's exciting for you to be at the nexus of it, to be the person that is able to help somebody transition from one aspect of their life to another and to see their rewards, they kind of become yours, right?
That's like the best part of my job.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't get to see the end. You just kind of get to see little bits, or maybe you get to see the worst of it. And, you know, but like to actually be connected with him and to not like intimately connected, but like to be connected through his journey has just been amazing. And I'm like, I'm proud of him every day. And, you know, I really wanted him to come on my radio show, but it was just a point in his journey where he just wasn't ready to talk about it like that. And, you know, I'm sure one day he will be, but it's, you know, maybe I'll cage him up and I'll bring the key to the radio station and
into a kink thing.
Yeah. So
it's weird because I also know several slaves, sissies, and cuckolded subs. And I would love to get their stories, but for the same reasons, they're very shy to talk about it on air because the amount of stigma that it comes with. So hopefully in this season, I might get some of these very submissive men to come in and discuss what that's like, because it should open up the gates for others of you listening who want to be able to explore these things safely and don't have the opportunity or don't have the wherewithal to be able to navigate it because you've been shamed and guilted and people made you feel like shit for something that you shouldn't feel like shit for.
Hashtag Sissy September.
Ooh, do you have one for every month?
No.
Anal August, Sissy September.
What would October be?
What would October be? Ovulating October. Ovulating October. No, what are the oval balls?
Yes!
Right, those oval eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go.
Alien egg insertion, oval egg October.
Yeah.
Look into that. You got a lot of things to Google after this episode.
Yeah.
But we need to come back another time and do another one. So for the time being, can you do a plug? Or many plugs, actually. Where can people find you? What's exciting and new? Where are you going to be? Go.
All right. Fabulous. So you can find me on inspireintimacy.com. There you can be connected to my events, my blog, where I post about what's going on in my life. I also repost my radio shows, any live streams that I'm doing, what my YouTube videos are doing. For some reason, one of them has reached over 40,000 views. Don't know how that happened. But through inspireintimacy.com, you can get connected to my Facebook, my Instagram, my Twitter, all those fun things.
Tweeter. Blog.
Yeah.
Love it. Alicia Fisher, you've been more overwhelming than I expected, and I love it. Thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
You're listening to Intellectual Erection, a place where we talk about the naughty to stimulate your thinking.